Random House Audio presents Double Cross, The True Story of the D-Day Spies by Ben McIntyre. Read for you by John Lee. For Cullum, Pablo, Minnie, and Wilf. Tangle within tangle, plot and counterplot, ruse and treachery, cross and double cross, true agent, false agent, double agent, gold and steel. The bomb, the dagger, and the firing party were interwoven in many a texture so intricate as to be incredible and yet true. Winston Churchill. The enemy must not know where I intend to give battle, for if he does not know where I intend to give battle, he must prepare in a great many places. And when he prepares in a great many places, those I have to fight in any one place will be few. And when he prepares everywhere, he will be weak everywhere. Sun Tzu. Preface. In the summer of 1943, a genteel and soft-spoken intelligence officer, wearing tartan trousers and smoking a pipe, put the finishing touches to a secret weapon he had been working on for more than 3 years. This weapon, unique in its power and unlimited in its range, was quite different from any built before or since. It was so shrouded in secrecy that its inventors were, for some time, unaware that they possessed it, and unsure how to use it. This weapon did not kill or maim. It did not rely on science, engineering, or force. It did not destroy cities, sink U-boats, or pierce the armor of panzers. It did something far more subtle. Instead of killing the enemy, it could make the Nazis think what the British wanted them to think, and therefore do what the British wanted them to do. Tar Robertson, of the British Security Service, better known as MI5, had built a weapon that could lie to Hitler, and at the most critical juncture of the Second World War, he urged Winston Churchill to use it. Allied military planners were already working on plans for the great assault on Nazi-occupied Europe. The D-Day invasion, so long awaited, would decide the outcome of the war, and both sides knew it. If the Allies could sweep across the English Channel and smash through the massive German coastal defences known as the Atlantic Wall, then the Nazis might be rolled back out of Paris, out of Brussels, and then across the Rhine all the way to Berlin. Hitler, however, was convinced that if the invaders could be successfully resisted in the early stages of an assault, even for one day, then the attack would fail. Allied morale would slump, and it would take many months before another invasion could be attempted. In that time, Hitler could concentrate on destroying the Red Army on the Eastern Front. The first 24 hours would be, in Erwin Rommel's famous words, the longest day. How that day would end was far from certain. D-Day stands today as a monumental victory, and, with hindsight, historically inevitable. It did not look that way in prospect. Amphibious assaults are among the most difficult operations in warfare. The Germans had constructed a zone of death along the coast more than 5 miles deep, a lethal obstacle course of barbed wire, concrete, and beaches sowed with 6 million mines. As Field Marshal Sir Alan Brooke, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, observed in a gloomy diary entry just before D-Day, "It may well be the most ghastly disaster of the whole war." In war, no variable is more important and less easy to control than the element of surprise. If the Germans could be confused, or, even better, actively misled as to where and when the landings would take place, then the odds of success improved dramatically. German forces in occupied France greatly outnumbered the invaders, but if they could be kept in the wrong place at the right time, then the numerical equation appeared less daunting. Conversely, if the Germans knew where the assault was coming, they would attack the invasion force at sea, as Rommel planned, and prevent the Allies from establishing a beachhead. By 1944, the war was claiming the lives of 10 million people a year. If Hitler had correctly anticipated the site of the D-Day invasion, then the war might have been extended for an additional year, or two, or more, with an incalculable cost in bloodshed and misery. The stakes could not have been higher, or the margin for error smaller. At the Tehran conference in November 1943, the first of the big three meetings, bringing together Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, the Allies laid plans for the invasion of Europe, codenamed Operation Overlord, which would take place in May 1944, later delayed by a month, with General Dwight Eisenhower as Supreme Allied Commander and General Bernard Montgomery as Allied Ground Forces Commander for the assault across the English Channel. During the conference, Winston Churchill turned to Joseph Stalin and uttered a typically Churchillian remark that has since become a sort of myth. In wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. Stalin, who had little time for literary metaphor, replied, "This is what we call military cunning." The D-Day invasion would be protected and supported by a comprehensive worldwide deception campaign, a body of lies to shield the truth. In a tip of the hat to Churchill's remark, it was codenamed Bodyguard. The central aim of Operation Bodyguard was to fool the Germans into believing the invasion was coming at a point where it was not, and that it was not coming in the place where it was. More than that, to ensure that those troops preparing to fight off the bogus invasion were not redeployed to repel the real one, the deception must be maintained after D-Day. Goliath could be cut down to size only if he didn't know which direction David's slingshot was coming from and was kept guessing. The target range for a cross-channel invasion, however, was extremely narrow. The Germans were sure to spot the build-up of troops in Britain, and since the assault had to take place within fighter range, there were only a handful of suitable spots for a massed landing. In the words of one planner, it was utterly impossible to disguise the fact that the major attack would come somewhere between the Cherbourg Peninsula and Dunkirk. The most obvious target was the Pas-de-Calais in the northeast, the region nearest the British coast. Deep water ports at Calais and Boulogne could easily be resupplied and reinforced once they were in Allied hands, and a bridgehead in Calais would offer the most direct route for a march on Paris and the German industrial heartland in the Ruhr. The logic of attacking Calais was not lost on German tacticians. Hitler himself identified Calais as the likeliest target. "It is here that the enemy must envil attack, and it is here, unless all the indications are misleading, that the decisive battle against the landing forces will be fought." Hitler was fully alert to the possibility of being misled. He had been wrong-footed over the invasions of North Africa and Sicily. He would be far harder to dupe this time. By July 1943, Allied military planners had concluded that, in spite of the obvious advantages of the Pas-de-Calais provided by its proximity to our coasts, the coast of Normandy, north of Caen, represented a better target. The Normandy beaches were long, wide, and gently sloping, with suitable gaps in the dunes through which an invading force could spread quickly inland. The lack of a deep water anchorage would be ingeniously solved by constructing vast artificial ports, codenamed Mulberry Harbours. The successful deception surrounding the Sicilian landings in 1943 had persuaded the Germans that the most likely target was not the real target. Now the aim was reversed. Hitler must be made to think that the most plausible target really was the target. If generals always fight the last battle, then this one might be won. Along the mighty 1,600-mile Atlantic wall, the brickwork was thinnest in Normandy. That was where the wrecking ball would hit. But in order to strike with maximum effect, the truth would need to be protected by a bodyguard of liars, which is precisely what Tar Robertson had created. Robertson and the small team of intelligence officers under his command specialized in turning German spies into double agents. This was the Double Cross system, coordinated by the intensely secret 20 Committee, so named because the number 20 in Roman numerals, XX, forms a double cross. Hitherto, these double agents, several dozen in number, had been used defensively to catch more spies, obtain information about German military intelligence, and lull the enemy into believing he was running a large and efficient espionage network in Britain, when he was running nothing of the sort. In June 1943, Robertson reached the startling conclusion that every single German agent in Britain was actually under his control. Not some, not most, but all of them. Which meant that Robertson's team of double agents could now begin feeding the Germans not just snippets of falsehood, but a gigantic, war-changing lie. The D-Day deception plot involved every branch of the secret war machine. Scientists laid false trails, engineers built dummy tanks, radio operators put up a barrage of fake signals, and counterfeit generals led non-existent armies toward targets that were never in danger. While the overall global deception campaign was codenamed Bodyguard, the plan specifically covering the cross-channel invasion, the pivotal element in the deception, was named Fortitude, the quality most essential to its success. Operation Fortitude, the ruse to bottle up German troops in the Pas-de-Calais and keep them there, was an extraordinary collective effort, but at its core, it depended on Robertson's spies and a web of deception so intricate and strong that it would snare Hitler's armies and help to carry thousands of soldiers across the Channel in safety. The military saga of D-Day has been described many times, and the role of Operation Fortitude in that victory, though long shrouded in secrecy, has slowly emerged since the war. But the story of the five spies who formed the nucleus of the double-cross system, Robertson's secret weapons, has never been fully told before. The spies themselves expected their story to remain hidden, as it would have had MI5 not chosen, in recent years, to declassify its wartime intelligence files. Indeed, if their stories had been told at the time, no one would have believed them. For the D-Day spies were, without question, one of the oddest military units ever assembled. They included a bisexual Peruvian playgirl, a tiny Polish fighter pilot, a mercurial French woman, a Serbian seducer, and a deeply eccentric Spaniard with a diploma in chicken farming. Together, under Robertson's guidance, they delivered all the little lies that together made up the big lie. Their success depended on the delicate, dubious relationship between spy and spy masters, both German and British. This is a story of war, but it is also about the nuanced qualities of psychology, character, and personality, the thin line between fidelity and treachery, truth and falsehood, and the strange impulsion of the spy. The double-cross spies were, variously, courageous, treacherous, capricious, greedy, and inspired. They were not obvious heroes, and their organization was betrayed from within by a Soviet spy. One was so obsessed with her pet dog that she came close to derailing the entire invasion. All were, to some extent, fantasists, for that is the very essence of espionage. Two were of dubious moral character. One was a triple and possibly a quadruple agent. For another, the game ended in torture, imprisonment, and death. All weapons, including secret ones, are liable to backfire. Robertson and his spies knew only too keenly that if their deception was found out, then rather than diverting attention from Normandy and tying up German troops in the Pas-de-Calais, they would lead the Germans to the truth, with catastrophic consequences. German troops could be redeployed from Calais to Normandy in a matter of days. Every hour the deception held firm would be measured in thousands of lives saved. If it failed, the butcher's bill would soar. As it was, D-Day was a damn close-run thing and a brutal struggle. Allied casualty rates averaged 6,674 a day for the 77 days of the Normandy campaign. Those numbers would have been far higher had it not been for a small and most peculiar band of men and women fighting a secret battle. The D-Day spies were not traditional warriors. None carried weapons, yet the soldiers who did owed the spies a huge and unconscious debt as they stormed the beaches of Normandy in June 1944. These secret agents fought exclusively with words, drama, and make-believe. Their tales begin before the outbreak of war, but then overlap, interconnect, and finally interlock on D-Day, in the greatest deception operation ever attempted. Their real names are a mouthful, a sort of European mélange that might have sprung from a period novel. Elvira Concepción Josefina de la Fuente Chaudoir, Roman Chernyavsky, Lily Sergeyev, Dushko Popov, and Juan Puyol Garcia. The codenames are blunter and in each case were deliberately chosen. Bronx, Brutus, Treasure, Tricycle, and Garbo. This is their story. 1. Raw Recruits. Dushko and Johnny were friends. Their friendship was founded on a shared appreciation of money, cars, parties, and women, in no particular order, and preferably all at the same time. Their relationship, based almost entirely on frivolity, would have a profound impact on world history. Dushan Dushko Popov and Johann Johnny Jebsen met in 1936 at the University of Freiburg in southern Germany. Popov, the son of a wealthy Serbian industrialist from Dubrovnik, was 25. Jebsen, the heir to a large shipping company, was 19. Both were spoiled, charming, and feckless. Popov drove a BMW. Jebsen, a supercharged Mercedes 540K convertible. This inseparable pair of international playboys roistered around Freiburg, behaving badly. Popov was a law student, while Jebsen was taking an economics degree, the better to manage the family firm. Neither did any studying at all. "We both had some intellectual pretensions," wrote Popov, "but we were addicted to sports cars and sporting girls and had enough money to keep them both running." Popov had a round, open face, with hair brushed back from a high forehead. Opinion was divided on his looks. "He smiles freely, showing all his teeth, and in repose his face is not unpleasant, though certainly not handsome," wrote one male contemporary. "He had a well-flattened, typically Slav nose, complexion sallow, broad shoulders, athletic carriage, but rather podgy, white and well-kept hands, which he waved in wild gesticulation. Women frequently found him irresistible, with his easy manners, loose, sensual mouth, and green eyes behind heavy lids. He had what were then known as bedroom eyes. Indeed, the bedroom was his main focus of interest. Popov was an unstoppable womanizer. Jebsen cut a rather different figure. He was slight and thin, with dark blonde hair, high cheekbones, and a turned-up nose. Where Popov was noisily gregarious, Jebsen was watchful. His coldness, aloofness, could be forbidding, yet everyone was under his spell, Popov wrote. He had much warmth, too, and his intelligence was reflected in his face, in the alertness of his steel-blue eyes. He spoke abruptly, in short phrases, hardly ever used an adjective, and was, above all, ironic. Jebsen walked with a limp, and hinted that this was from an injury sustained in some wild escapade. In truth, it was caused by the pain of varicose veins, to which he was a secret martyr. He loved to spin a story, to deliberately stir up situations to see what would happen. But he also liked to broker deals. When Popov was challenged to a sword duel over a girl, it was Jebsen, as his second, who quietly arranged a peaceful solution, to Popov's relief, not thinking my looks would be improved by a bright red cicatrix. Jebsen's parents, both dead by the time he arrived in Freiburg, had been born in Denmark, but adopted German citizenship when the shipping firm, Jebsen and Jebsen, moved to Hamburg. Jebsen was born in that city in 1917, but liked to joke that he was really Danish, his German citizenship being a flag of convenience for business purposes. "Some of my love of my country has to do with so much of it actually belonging to me." A rich, rootless orphan, Jebsen had visited Britain as a teenager and returned a committed Anglophile. He affected English manners, spoke English in preference to German, and dressed, he thought, like a young Anthony Eden, conservatively elegant. Popov remarked, "He would no more go without an umbrella than without his trousers." Preoccupied as they were with having fun, the two student friends could not entirely ignore the menacing political changes taking place around them in the Germany of the 1930s. They made a point of teasing the pro-Nazi student intelligentsia. The mockery, however, had a metal strand to it. Under that mask of a snob and cynic, and under his playboy manners, Jebsen was developing a deep distaste for Nazism. Popov found the posturing Nazi brown shirts ridiculous and repulsive. After graduation, Popov returned to Yugoslavia and set himself up in the import-export business, travelling widely. Jebsen headed to England, announcing that he intended to study at Oxford University and write books on philosophy. He did neither, though he would later claim to have done both. They would not meet again for 3 years, by which time the world was at war. In early 1940, Popov was living in Dubrovnik, where he had opened his own law firm and conducting affairs with at least 4 women, when he received a telegram from his old friend summoning him to Belgrade. "Need to meet you urgently." Their reunion was joyful and spectacularly bibulous. They went on a bender through Belgrade's night spots, having enlisted 2 girls from the chorus of one of the clubs. At dawn, all 4 sat down to a breakfast of steak and champagne. Jebsen told Popov that in the intervening years he had become acquainted with the great English writer, P.G. Wodehouse. With his monocle and silk cravat, Jebsen now looked like an oddly Germanic version of Bertie Wooster. Popov studied his old friend. Jebsen wore the same expression of sharp intelligence, cynicism, and dark humor, but he also seemed tense, as if there was something weighing on his mind. He chain-smoked and ordered his whiskies double, neat, and frequently. In style, his clothes still rivaled Eden's, but his blonde hair was no longer so closely trimmed, and he had a neglected mustache, reddened by tobacco. A few days later, the friends were alone at the bar of a Belgrade hotel, when Jebsen lowered his voice, looked around in a ludicrously conspiratorial manner, and confided that he had joined the Abwehr, the German military intelligence service, because it saved him from soldiering, of which he was very much afraid, as he is a heavy sufferer from varicose veins. Jebsen's recruiter was a family friend, Colonel Hans Oster, deputy to Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, the chief of the Abwehr. He now had the formal but vague Abwehr title of Forscher, meaning researcher or talent scout, with the technical rank of private, attached to a 400-strong special detachment of the Brandenburg Regiment. This unit was, in reality, a wrangle by Canaris to keep a number of young men out of the clutches of compulsory service. Jebsen was a freelance spy on permanent leave from the army, with a personal assurance from Canaris that he would never wear a uniform, never undergo military training, and never be sent to war. He was free to spend his time travelling throughout Europe on his private business and financial affairs, so long as he held himself available to help the Abwehr when called upon to do so. "Hitler is the undisputed master of Europe," Jebsen declared. "In a few months' time he'll probably finish off England, and then America and Russia will be glad to come to terms with him." This was pure Nazi propaganda, but Jebsen's expression, as usual, was glintingly ironic. "Would you dine with a friend of mine?" Jebsen asked suddenly, a member of the German embassy. The friend turned out to be one Major Münzinger, a corpulent Bavarian and the most senior Abwehr officer in the Balkans. Over brandy and cigars, Münzinger made his pitch to Popov, as subtle as a sledgehammer. "No country can resist the German army. In a couple of months, England will be invaded. To facilitate the German task and to make an eventual invasion less bloody, you could help." Münzinger shifted to flattery. Popov was well connected. His business was the ideal cover for travelling to Britain, where he must know many important and influential people. Why did he not know the Duke of Kent himself? Popov nodded. He did not admit that he had visited Britain only once in his life and had met the Duke for a matter of minutes at Dubrovnik's Argosy Yacht Club. Münzinger continued, "We have many agents in England, quite a number of them excellent, but your connections would open many doors. You could render us great service, and we could do the same for you. The Reich knows how to show its appreciation." Jebsen drank his whiskey and said nothing. Münzinger was somewhat vague about the kind of information Popov might gather. "General, political." And then, after a pause, "Military. Johnny will introduce you to the proper people when and if you accept. Popoff asked for time to think the offer over, and in the morning he accepted. Jepsen had recruited his first spy for German intelligence. He would never recruit another. Popoff, meanwhile, had begun to develop what he called a little idea of my own. In 1941, the Inter Allié was the most important spy network in Nazi-occupied France. Indeed, as one British intelligence officer remarked, it was virtually the only one, our sole source of information from France, in the early part of the war. The network consisted of scores of informers, agents, and sub-agents, but ultimately the Inter Allié was the creation of one spy, a man to whom conspiracy and subterfuge were second nature, who regarded espionage as a vocation. His French collaborators knew him as Armand Borny. He also used the codename Valenti, or Valentine. His real name was Roman Tchernovsky, and in a very short time, through sheer energy, conviction, and a soaring sense of his own worth, he had become the most valuable British spy in France. Tchernovsky was a Polish patriot, but that phrase cannot do justice to his essential Polishness and the depths of his attachment to his motherland. He lived for Poland and was perfectly prepared, at times almost anxious, to die for it. His loyalty is entirely to his own country, and every problem he sees is bound up with the destiny of the Polish people, wrote one of his fellow spies. He loathed the Germans and Russians with equal intensity for carving up his country, and dreamed only of restoring the Polish nation. Every other loyalty, every other consideration, was secondary. He stood just 5'6" tall, with a thin face and intense, close-set eyes. He smiled readily and spoke at machine-gun speed. The son of a well-to-do Warsaw financier, Tchernovsky had trained as a fighter pilot before the war, but a serious crash had left him partially sighted and desk-bound. The German invasion of Poland in September 1939 found Captain Tchernovsky at Air Force headquarters in Warsaw, a specialist in military intelligence and the author of a well-received treatise on counterintelligence. Tchernovsky was a professional, a man who lives and thinks spying, as one colleague put it. He regarded the spy trade as an honorable calling, based on the highest ideals of human endeavor. As the Polish army crumbled beneath the German onslaught, Tchernovsky escaped to Romania, and then, using forged documents, made his way to France, where Polish forces were regrouping. When France fell in 1940, his division was disbanded, but rather than join his compatriots in Britain to continue the fight from there, Tchernovsky went underground. He persuaded a young French widow, René Borny, to lend him her late husband's identity. As German troops began their occupation, a peasant, whose papers identified him as Armand Borny, wobbled along beside them on a borrowed bicycle, taking mental notes and already congratulating himself. Every signpost, every sign on a truck, every distinguishing mark of any sort, meant far more to me than to anybody else. Here were the seeds of what he would grandly refer to as his vision. While the Polish government in exile in London fought one kind of war, he would mount another. He imagined small cells of resistance, multiplying with great speed, joining together and forming one screen of eyes. Tchernovsky made his way to the unoccupied south of France, where he made contact with the Polish Secret Service and obtained formal approval for his plan to establish a network in the occupied zone. A few nights later, he was dining alone at La Frégate, a restaurant in Toulouse, when a young woman asked if she might occupy the empty seat at his table. She was small, in her 30s. Her pale, thin face, with thin lips, was animated by very vivid eyes. Mathilde Carré simultaneously sized up her diminutive and accidental dining companion, thin and muscular, with a long, narrow face, rather large nose, and green eyes, which must originally have been clear and attractive, but were now flecked with contusions as the result of a flying accident. Tchernovsky introduced himself in an appalling French accent. They fell into conversation. After dinner, he walked her home, Mathilde Carré was highly intelligent, overwrought, and at the moment she met Tsarnavsky, teetering on the edge of a nervous breakdown. The child of bourgeois Parisian parents, she had studied at the Sorbonne, worked briefly in an insurance company, trained as a teacher, and then married a childhood friend before swiftly discovering she could not stand him. The war was the excuse she needed to leave her husband. With the French army in retreat, she found work in a dressing station, treating the wounded. There she met a lieutenant in the French Foreign Legion and made love to him, under the eyes of an enormous crucifix, in the bishop's cell of a seminary at the Caserre-sur-Garonne. He was gone in the morning, and she was pregnant. She decided to keep the baby and then miscarried. One night, she stood on a high bridge, about to kill herself, but then changed her mind. Instead of throwing myself into the Garonne, I would fling myself into the war. If I really intended to commit suicide, it would be more intelligent to commit a useful suicide. To celebrate this decision, she had taken herself out to dinner at La Frégate. Tsarnavsky's abundant self-assurance made Mathilde feel instantly secure. Every time he spoke of the war, his eyes flashed. He would not accept that Poland had been defeated. He radiated a kind of confidence and the enthusiasm of youth, an intelligence and willpower which would alternately give place to the airs of a spoilt, affectionate child. They met again the next night, and the next. A great bond of friendship was swiftly forged. Both would later deny they had ever been lovers, with such vehemence that the denials were almost certainly untrue. 3 weeks after their first meeting, Tsarnavsky confessed that he was a spy, and asked Mathilde to help him realize his vision of a multi-celled intelligence network. She said he could count on her. Together they would do great things. The theatricality of the moment was compounded by Tsarnavsky's announcement that he had already selected a code name for his new accomplice. She would be La Chatte, the she-cat, because you walk so quietly in your soft shoes, like a cat. She raised the slim fingers of one hand in a claw. And I can scratch as well if I wish. Perhaps it was a warning. Roman Tsarnavsky and Mathilde Carré formed a most effective spy partnership. In Paris, they rented a room in Montmartre and set about constructing an entire espionage network. It will be inter-allied, Tsarnavsky announced. The boss will be a Pole, the agents mostly French, and all working for the Allies. The Inter-Allié network was born. Mathilde acted as chief recruiter, since some Frenchmen declined to work for a Pole, while Roman gathered, collated, typed, and dispatched intelligence material to London. The first recruits were Monique Deschamps, codenamed Moustique, Mosquito, a tiny, chain-smoking firebrand of a woman, and René Aubertin, a former French Army tank commander. Gradually, the network expanded to include railway workers, police, fishermen, criminals, and housewives. They sent whatever intelligence they had gathered to one of numerous post boxes across Paris, the lavatory attendant at La Palette, the Belit language school by the Opera, and a concierge en Rue Lamarque, who had received a bayonet thrust in the buttocks when the Germans entered Paris, so it was only natural that he should hate them. Mathilde gathered up their intelligence. In her black fur coat, red hat, and small, flat, red shoes, she moved swiftly from one appointment to another, wrote Tsarnavsky, bringing new contacts, new possibilities, leaving me free to concentrate on studying the news from our agents and condensing it into our reports. Tsarnavsky's aim was to build up a complete picture of German forces in occupied France, the order of battle, troop positions and movements, ammunition dumps, aerodromes, naval and radar installations. To defeat the enemy, you have to know where he is. The more exactly you know where he is, the easier it can be, he wrote. He typed up the condensed reports on tissue paper. Every few weeks, a courier, codenamed Rapide, a tall, thin Pole of indeterminate age with a muddy complexion and a small black mustache, boarded the 11 a.m. Marseille train for Bordeaux at the Gare de Lyon. 10 minutes before departure, he locked himself in the first-class toilet. Over the toilet bowl was a metal sign reading, "Remplacez le couvercle après l'usage." Inserting a handkerchief between screwdriver and screw to avoid telltale scratching, Rapide carefully loosened the sign plate, inserted the tissue paper report behind, and then screwed it back on. After the train had crossed the border into unoccupied France, an agent of Polish intelligence would perform the procedure in reverse, retrieving the report and inserting a reply to be picked up when the train arrived back in Paris. From unoccupied France, Polish intelligence relayed the message, via courier, through the neutral Iberian Peninsula to the Polish government in exile in London, which passed it on to the British Secret Services. Every one of Czernowski's reports ended up with MI6, Britain's foreign intelligence organization, more formally known as the Secret Intelligence Service, or SIS. The network, or La Famille, as they called it, expanded swiftly. A radio the size of a portable typewriter was smuggled across the border from Vichy, France, installed in a top-floor flat near the Trocadero, and used to send coded information. René Barny, the widow who had furnished Czernowski's false identity, moved to Paris to work on coding and decoding the wireless messages. Czernowski gave her the codename Violette. She became his lover. By the middle of 1941, Czernowski could boast, with only slight exaggeration, that his big network composed of French patriots, directed by a Pole and working for England, was now the last stronghold of Allied resistance against Germany. Three more underground wireless stations were established. Some reports were 400 pages long, including maps and diagrams. Impossible to send by radio, these were photographed and the undeveloped film smuggled across the Spanish border, packed in such a way that, opened by an unauthorized person, it would be exposed to the light and so made useless. Interallié intelligence poured into London in a swelling torrent, even more detailed and precise, and sometimes so fast that its recipients could not keep up. When a spy discovered the route intended for the personal train of Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring, Czernowski immediately radioed the information to London, and was dismayed when the train was not attacked. A message arrived the next day. Göring train, sorry, we got the news too late to use it for the RAF, stop. Inevitably, there were tensions within the group. Mathilde loathed René, considering her a typical little provincial woman and badly dressed. Czernowski insisted that there was no question of any jealousy, but he reflected that Mathilde was a strange woman, idealistic but ruthless, ambitious, and very nervous and highly strung. In the autumn of 1941, Czernowski was told to report to an airfield near Compiègne, where a plane would pick him up to bring him to London for a debriefing. On October 1st, an RAF Lysander glided out of the sky, piloted by a man with a moustache whose only French, by way of greeting, was "C'est la vie." On arrival in England, Czernowski was met by Colonel Stanislav Gano, the head of Polish intelligence. "You've kept us all busy on this side," said Gano, who looked, Czernowski thought, like the head of some business firm. For 24 hours, Czernowski was quizzed on every aspect of his network. Gano seemed particularly interested in Mathilde Carré. "We are perfect partners," Czernowski assured him. Finally, to his amazement, he was ushered into the presence of General Władysław Sikorski, the Polish Prime Minister. Sikorski gravely declared that Czernowski had been awarded the Virtuti Militari, the highest Polish military decoration. "I was petrified by the suddenness, unexpectedness, and solemnity of the moment," Czernowski later wrote. He would soon be dropped by parachute back into France to continue his work. The little Polish spy was proud, but with gratification came a niggling doubt, a small, premonitory stab of anxiety. Subconsciously, I felt a disturbing uneasiness. Elvira de la Fuente Chaudoir spent night after night at the gaming tables in Hamilton's Club, or Crockford's Casino in Mayfair. And though she sometimes won, she always lost in the end. It was most frustrating. But when Elvira wasn't gambling, she was bored to death, which was why she had agreed to have lunch with a man who, she had been told, might offer her a most interesting and well-paid job. Boredom stalked Elvira Chaudoir like a curse. Her father, a Peruvian diplomat, had made a fortune from guano, the excrement of seabirds, bats, and seals, collected off the coast of Peru and exported as fertilizer. Elvira grew up in Paris, where she was expensively educated and tremendously spoiled. In 1934, at the age of 23, to escape the tedium, she fled into the arms of Jean Chaudoir, a Belgian stock exchange representative for a gold mining firm. Jean turned out to be a crashing bore, and life in Brussels was exceedingly dull. After 4 years of marriage and a number of unsatisfactory love affairs with both men and women, she came to the conclusion that she had nothing in common with her husband, and ran away to Cannes with her best friend, Romy Gilby, who was married to a scion of the Gilby gin dynasty and very rich. Elvira and Mrs. Gilby were happily losing money made from gin in a casino in Cannes when the Germans invaded France. They fled in an open-top Renault to Saint-Malo before taking a boat for England. In London, Elvira moved into a flat on Sloane Street, but the tedium of life swiftly descended once more. She spent her evenings shuttling between the bar at the Ritz and the bridge tables, losing money she did not have. She would have borrowed from her parents, but they were stuck in France. She tried to join the Free French forces gathering around the exile Charles de Gaulle, but was told she was unsuitable. She did a little translating for the BBC and found it dreary. She complained, to anyone who would listen, that she could not get an interesting job because she was Peruvian. One of those who happened to be listening, one night at Hamilton's, was an RAF officer, who told a friend in military intelligence, who passed her name on to someone in MI6. And so it was that Elvira Chaudoir now found herself, at the age of 29, in the grill room of the Connaught Hotel, sitting across the table from a middle-aged man in a rumpled suit with a bristling white moustache and the eyes of a hyperactive ferret. He had introduced himself as Mr. Maysfield. His real name was Lieutenant Colonel Claude Edward Marjorie Banks Danzy, also known as Haywood, Uncle Claude, and Colonel Zed. He was Assistant Chief of MI6. Claude Danzy was witty, spiteful, and widely disliked by his fellow spies. Hugh Trevor Roper, the waspish historian who worked in wartime intelligence, considered him to be an utter shit, corrupt, incompetent, but with a certain low cunning. Danzy was a most unpleasant man and a most experienced spy. They made an odd couple, Elvira, tall and overdressed, with a sweet, rather innocent face, her auburn hair arranged into a question mark over her forehead. Danzy, small, bald, bespectacled, and intense. Elvira rather liked this fizzing little man, and as the conversation unfolded, it became clear that he knew a great deal about her. He knew about Mrs. Gilby and the unsuccessful evenings at the bridge tables. He knew her father had been appointed Peruvian chargé d'affaires to the collaborationist Vichy government in France. He knew what was, or rather what was not, in her bank account. I realized he must have been tapping my telephone. There was no other way he could have learned so much about me and my friends, she later reflected. Danzy offered her a job. Her Peruvian passport, he explained, meant that she could travel with comparative ease in occupied Europe, and her father's diplomatic status would provide cover for an extended visit to Vichy France. She could report on political matters, but more important, she might get herself recruited as an agent by the Germans. This is the intelligence technique known as coat trailing, dangling a potential recruit before the opposition in the hope that, if recruited, he or she can then be put to work as a double agent. She would be well paid for her efforts. Elvira did not hesitate. The MI6 assessment of its new recruit was blunt. Attractive in appearance, she speaks fluent French, English, and Spanish. She is intelligent and has a quick brain, but is probably rather lazy about using it. A member of the international smart gambling set, her friends are to be found in any of the smart bridge clubs in London. Surveillance revealed that her tastes appear to be in the direction of the high spots. Police reported hilarious parties at the Sloane Street flat, with rowdy behaviour, singing and shouting late at night, and the arrival of drunken men and women in the small hours. Deputy Chief Constable Joseph Goulder noted, with disapproval and some understatement, that Mrs. Chaudoir favours the companionship of women who may not be careful of their virginity. Though Elvira might have come across as some dizzy-headed socialite, in reality she was bright and resourceful, and with a cast-iron cover. A good-time girl with no interests beyond the next cocktail, the next bed partner, and the next bet. She was also attractive to both sexes and hungry for cash, qualities that might come in useful. As Danzy knew from a lifetime of espionage, even the most intelligent and discreet of people will tend to indiscretion if they think they are talking to a foolish and beddable woman. In a flat in Knightsbridge, Elvira was taught how to use secret ink, using a match head impregnated with a chemical powder. Once in France, she would write apparently innocuous letters to a cover address in Lisbon. Between the lines of those letters, I was to insert my intelligence reports, penned in an undetectable fluid that could be developed by Danzy's technicians. Elvira was a swift learner. She is very intelligent and quick to grasp essentials, her instructor reported. Her budding spy career very nearly came to an early end when a certain sub-Lieutenant Burnett of the Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve reported that, one night at Crockford's, he had overheard Elvira Chaudoir boasting that she was being taught a secret service code in the neighbourhood of St. James's, and that shortly she was to be sent to Vichy. Elvira was given a severe scolding, and told that she must abstain from divulging information which may have come to her knowledge. Chastened, she promised to be more discreet, but the incident had demonstrated one of her more aggravating and endearing traits. Like many spies, she found it hard to keep a secret. Elvira was given the oddly masculine codename Cyril and told to stand ready to go to France. Her war was about to become very interesting indeed. Juan Puyol Garcia had been many things in his short life: cinema proprietor, businessman, cavalry officer, though he feared horses, and reluctant soldier. He had spent most of the Spanish Civil War in hiding from Francoist forces. A graduate of the Royal Poultry School at Arenys de Mar, Spain's most prestigious college for chicken farmers, he ran a poultry farm outside Barcelona, though he hated chickens. Puyol had no head for figures, and the business went bust. Stocky and spry, with a high forehead and warm brown eyes with a slightly mischievous tint, he looked like a fighting bantam. When the Second World War broke out, Puyol decided he wanted to spy for the British. "I must do something," he told himself, "something practical. I must make my contribution toward the good of humanity." Hitler was a psychopath, Puyol concluded, and so he must support the Allies. "I wanted to work for them, to supply them with confidential information which would be of interest to the Allied cause, politically or militarily." Quite where and how he would obtain such information he had yet to work out. "My plans were fairly confused," he later admitted. His memoirs, written many years later, suggest that his quixotic, deeply held determination to fight Hitler sprang from an aggressive form of pacifism and an abiding distrust of political extremism in any form. He was a supremely gentle soul, proud never to have fired a gun. He planned to fight Nazism in a different way. "I was fascinated by the origin of words," he wrote many years later. "The pen is mightier than the sword. I believe this sincerely and absolutely. I have devoted the greater part of my life to this ideal, using all my talents, all my convictions, all possible schemes, machinations, and stratagems." Puyol would fight a unique sort of war, with words as his only weapons. In January 1941, the 29-year-old Catalan approached the British Embassy in Madrid with an offer to spy against the Germans. He was politely but firmly told to go away. In a variant of Groucho Marx's dictum, the British did not want anyone in the club who wanted to be a member. Puyol next tried the Germans, pretending to be a keen fascist, willing to spy against the British, in the hope that once recruited, he could then betray them. The Germans told him they were extremely busy. But the little Catalan with the oddly intense eyes continued to badger the Germans in Spain, schooling himself in National Socialism until he could rant away as befitted a staunch Nazi. Finally, mostly to get him to shut up, the German said that if he could get to Britain via Lisbon, he would be considered for intelligence work. This was enough for Puyol. From that point on, he began to worm his way into German confidences, and in particular those of Major Karl Erich Kühlenthal of the Madrid Abwehr Station. Kühlenthal would be comprehensively duped in the course of Operation Mincemeat, the deception in which a dead body was floated ashore in Spain carrying forged documents indicating an Allied landing in Greece rather than Sicily. The German officer was efficient, paranoid, and stupendously gullible. From Puyol's point of view, he was the ideal case officer. Kühlenthal duly equipped Puyol with secret ink, cash, the codename Agent Arabelle, and some advice. He should be careful not to underestimate the British, as they were a formidable enemy. On his arrival in Lisbon, Puyol once more contacted the British and once more was rejected. This left him in something of a quandary, since he needed to start feeding information to the Germans as soon as possible. On July 19, 1941, he sent a telegram to Kühlenthal announcing his safe arrival in Britain. But he was not in Britain. Puyol was still in Portugal. Denied the opportunity to gather real intelligence for either side, he decided to invent it, with the help of the Lisbon Public Library, second-hand books, and whatever he could glean from newsreels. He dug out the names and addresses of real British munitions companies, consulted the Blue Guide to England for relevant place names, and used a Portuguese publication entitled The British Fleet as a primer on naval matters. Puyol had never been to Britain. He simply imagined it, sending back detailed, long-winded reports about things he thought he might have seen had he been there. Puyol's style was exhaustingly verbose, a thicket of clauses and subclauses, adjectival swamps, and overwrought sentences that stretched to a distant grammatical horizon. He would later claim that this extraordinary writing style was a way of filling up the page without saying very much. Though he loved to play with words, his reports were full of glaring errors. He could never get a grip on British military nomenclature or culture. Imagining that Glaswegian drinking habits must be similar to those in Spain, he wrote, "There are men here who would do anything for a liter of wine." His German controllers not only failed to spot his mistakes, but heaped praise on Agent Arabelle, particularly when he claimed to have recruited two sub-agents in Britain who were, of course, entirely fictional. For 9 months, Puyol remained in Lisbon, doing what spies, when stuck for real information, have always done, inventing what he thought his spy masters wanted to hear. He would continue to make it up magnificently for the rest of the war. Major Emil Kliemann of the German Abwehr was having a most agreeable war. Occupied Paris was an exceptionally pleasant place to be, if you happened to be one of the occupiers. He had an office on the Champs-Élysées, a comfortable apartment near the Bois de Boulogne, plenty of disposable cash, and very little to do. Most important, he had a new mistress named Yvonne Delidaise, a French woman with a German mother. Yvonne was demanding, expensive, and 20 years his junior. His dumpy Austrian wife was still in Vienna and certain to remain there. This was also a source of satisfaction. Kliemann's job was recruiting informers and ferreting out French spies, but his indefatigable colleague, Hugo Bleicher, seemed happy to do the hard work, which was just fine with Kliemann. A Viennese businessman posted to Paris in June 1940, Kliemann had little time for Nazism. Indeed, he did not particularly like Germans, and rather hoped that Germany would not win the war too quickly, as he wanted nothing more than to continue his newfound Parisian life, making love to Yvonne and meeting the odd dodgy character in his favourite café, Chez Valérie. Portly and broad-shouldered, Kliemann wore a neatly clipped moustache and a gold signet ring on the third finger of his left hand, with the initials E.K. He dressed with what he considered understated elegance, dyed his sideburns, and wore his hair carefully parted and greased down. He played the violin and collected antique porcelain. At 43, Major Emil Kliman was vain, romantic, clever, staggeringly lazy, and consistently unpunctual. As befits a spy chief, he had assembled an impressive number of aliases: Kilberg, von Kasteit, Polo, Octave, and Monsieur Jean, though not a single workable spy. On October 13, 1941, Kliman reluctantly arranged to meet a potential recruit, a 29-year-old French woman of Russian origin, recommended by one of his colleagues. Her name was Lily Sergeyev. Kliman was 2 hours late for their rendezvous at the Café du Rond-Point. The young woman waiting at the corner table was handsome without being beautiful. She had curly brown hair, bright blue eyes, and a square chin. In fluent German, Lily Sergeyev, who also spelled her name Sergueyev and occasionally Sergueyev, explained that she was a journalist and a painter. Her father had been a Tsarist government official, but after the revolution, when Lily was 5, the family had emigrated to Paris. Her grandfather, she announced with pride, had been the last Imperial Russian ambassador to Serbia. Her uncle, General Yevgeny Miller, had commanded the 5th Russian Army in the First World War, and then vanished in 1937 and been executed in Moscow 2 years later. Her father now sold cars. Her mother was a dressmaker. She considered herself French. She wanted to spy for Germany. Kliman was intrigued. Lily seemed vivacious, intelligent, and, most important, interested in Kliman. He invited her to dinner at the Cascade restaurant near the Bois de Boulogne, explaining that Yvonne, his secretary, would meet them there. The young woman insisted on bringing her dog, a small white male terrier poodle cross named Babs, to which she was obviously devoted. Once they were seated in the restaurant, Lily told her story. A restless spirit, she had made a number of epic journeys across Europe by bicycle and on foot, including one that had taken her through Hitler's Germany. There she had been impressed by the efficiency of the Nazi regime and had written a series of admiring articles for the French press. She had even interviewed Göring, who had promised to obtain for her a personal interview with Hitler. This had not materialized. In 1937, a German journalist named Felix Dassel, whom she had met on her travels, had told her that he was working for German intelligence and asked Lily if she wanted a job. She had declined, but when the Germans marched into Paris, Dassel had reappeared. Over dinner at Maxim's, she had told him that the British had let the French down badly and that she had no love for them. Dassel had asked her again if she was prepared to work for the Germans. This time she had accepted. It was Dassel who had recommended that Kliman arrange this meeting. Yvonne was yawning by this point in Lily's story, but Kliman was curious. She seemed genuine enough, and enthusiastic, though nervous. "It might be quite easy for me to get to Portugal, to Australia, or to England," she said. "I have relatives in all those places, and nobody would be surprised if I wanted to get out of France." Kliman pondered. "I am interested in your project," he said finally. "I think we will send you to Portugal. I very much doubt that you will be allowed to go to England." Then, suddenly, Kliman caught Lily's wrist and fixed her with what he plainly believed was a penetrating spy-masterly stare. "Why do you want to work for us?" There was a long and uncomfortable pause. Her reply, when it came, was an odd one. "Major, you are an intelligent man. How much can my answer be worth to you?" "I can tell you that it is from conviction, a matter of principle, or because I love Germany, or else I hate the British. But if you were the enemy, if I were here to spy on you, to betray you, do you think that my answer would be any different? So will you allow me not to answer?" He smiled and replied that, of course, she was right. Kliman dropped off Lily and her little dog at her parents' flat near the Trocadero. "I will make contact again soon," said the Major. Then, as usual, he did nothing at all. In her diary, Lily wrote, "Babs lifts up his shaggy, truffle-like nose and looks at me inquiringly." The diary is written entirely in the present tense, and much of it is devoted to her dog. I take Babs on my knees, on the drawing-room sofa, and say in his pink ear, "It's a fine game. It's a grand game. But you know, if we lose it, we'll lose our lives. Or mine, at any rate." Babs would be the first to perish in the game. 2. A bit of an enigma. Dusko Popov, the Serbian playboy, was not as feckless and apolitical as he seemed. The invitation from his old friend Johnny Jebsen to work for German intelligence was an attractive one. The year 1940 was a time of deep anxiety as the German army rampaged across Europe. Poland had been under German occupation since September of the previous year. Denmark had been invaded in April, followed by Norway. Belgium and the Netherlands surrendered in May. France had fallen in June. Yugoslavia might be next. A Serbian businessman with interests across Europe would need German friends, and, as Popov told Jebsen, he was keen to get an easy living. But within days of accepting Major Münzinger's offer, Popov began to work on his own plan. A small seed of courage had taken root in this hitherto callow and shallow soul. A few days after the dinner with Münzinger, he contrived to bump into John Dew, first secretary at the British Embassy in Belgrade, at a legation party. In a quiet moment on the terrace, he told Dew that an old university chum, now an Abwehr officer, had made moves to recruit him. "Interesting," said Dew, who privately suspected Popov was an awful crook. "Be a good thing for you to keep in touch with that chap." Dew put Popov in contact with the MI6 station chief in the Yugoslav capital. "Continue your conversations with the Germans," Popov was advised. "Be friendly, but don't overdo it. Ask for time to prepare your trip." Johnny Jebsen laid out Popov's mission on behalf of German intelligence. He would travel to London via neutral Portugal under the guise of a businessman exporting raw materials from Yugoslavia to Britain. Once there, he should begin sending back information by writing letters in secret ink. This was the principal method of covert communication between spies, a way of passing information that was becoming something of an espionage art in 1940. Jebsen showed Popov how to make the ink using a tablet of pyramidon, a common treatment for headache, dissolved in white gin. When Popov had something to report, he should write an insignificant letter in type on one side of a piece of paper and use the ink and a sharpened matchstick to write invisibly on the other. The letter should then be sent to Maria Alera at an address in Lisbon, where it would be picked up by the Abwehr. When a developer chemical was applied to the paper, the secret writing would appear. Maria Alera was described by Jebsen as a young girl about 22, a journalist, mulatto, who would pass as his girlfriend. She would soon become exactly that. Popov would report to the Abwehr station in Lisbon. "Your spy master will be Major Ludovico von Karsthoff," Johnny explained. "You may find yourself liking him." Finally, Popov was handed a list of questions, covering subjects as diverse as Britain's coastal defences, deployment of troops, civilian morale, and politics. Who were Churchill's enemies? Who was in favour of starting to negotiate peace with Germany? Popov immediately handed the questionnaire over to MI6. By November, Popov, codenamed Ivan by his German handlers, was ready to go. Popov and Jebsen met for a farewell drink at the Serbian King Hotel in Belgrade. "We are now both in the same service," Jebsen remarked. There was something about his smile that gave Popov pause. Here was a German spy who was a devotee of P.G. Woodhouse, a mouthpiece for Nazi propaganda who said he was terrified of fighting, but who obviously relished the risky world of espionage, knew how to make secret ink, and professed himself strongly pro-British. Jebsen even employed a British secretary, Mabel Harbottle, a starchy English spinster who might have stepped from the pages of a Woodhouse novel. Miss Harbottle had formerly worked for Joachim von Ribbentrop, Hitler's foreign minister, and though a German citizen, Mabel remained British at heart. She flatly refused to type his letters unless reassured that whatever Jepsen was doing for the Germans could not hurt British interests. Jepsen gave her that assurance, an odd commitment from a man specifically employed by the German Reich to do as much damage as possible to British interests. As Popoff put it, Johnny was a bit of an enigma. The same was true of Jepsen's new boss, Admiral Canaris, one of the most puzzling figures of the Second World War. Supple and sinuous, and a master of the espionage game, Canaris was held in some awe by the other leaders of the Third Reich, including Hitler. Himmler loathed and distrusted him. So did Ribbentrop. Canaris was determined to win the espionage battle for Germany, yet his loyalties were shifting, his personal convictions opaque. He was openly friendly to Jews, and would help save many from the gas chambers. He made little secret of his disdain for the hysterical violence of the Nazis, and he ran the Abwehr, the great sprawling German intelligence machine, as a personal fiefdom, with little reference to the high command. But then, the Abwehr was itself an anomaly within the Nazi military structure. Its officers tended to be drawn from the German upper classes, old-fashioned military types with little sympathy for the boorish ideology of Nazism. Some were professionals, but many were lazy and corrupt, and a number of senior officers were actively opposed to the Hitler regime. "What is Canaris like?" Popov asked his old friend. "A sensitive man, unobtrusive," came the considered reply, "with much curiosity, vast intelligence, and a great sense of humor. He gives the impression of preferring to listen rather than to speak." Johnny Jepsen might have been describing himself. Popov would later insist that Jepsen knew from the outset that he would make contact with the British and wanted him to do so. Secretly anti-Nazi, a devoted Anglophile, Jepsen was already playing a subtle and dangerous double game. Popov was only pretending to work for the Germans, and Jepsen, it seemed, was only pretending to believe that he was. Each was lying. Both knew it, and neither admitted it. "There was a curious ambiguity about friendship for people in our positions," wrote Popov. "You tried to convince yourself that a friend would be on the right side, yet you couldn't dare trust that friendship far enough to reveal yourself." Popov arrived a week later in Lisbon, where he was met by a chauffeur and driven in an Opel sedan to a large stucco villa in the Moorish style, in the seaside resort of Estoril. At the door of Villa Tokiana, he was greeted by a gentlemanly figure with a warm smile and a mass of blackish hair on his hands. Popov was training himself to spot distinguishing features. "I have been instructed to help you to the utmost," said his host. "You have inspired a lot of faith at the Tirpitzuther, Abwehr headquarters in Berlin, and they are making ambitious plans for you." Johnny had been right. Popov felt immediately drawn to Ludovico von Karsthoff. He was tall and dark, and his movements were those of a big cat. Von Karsthoff gave Popov the name of another German agent in London, a Czechoslovak named Georges Graf, who could be contacted in case of emergencies. In the evening, Popov and von Karsthoff drank champagne and dined sumptuously. Though Popov would never know it, von Karsthoff's real name was Krämer von Auenroder, an educated and worldly aristocrat from Trieste, whose main objective was to get through the war with maximum pleasure and minimum danger. At dawn, on December 20th, 1940, Dushko Popov, Yugoslavian businessman, alighted at Whitchurch Airport near Bristol. There he was met by Jock Horsfall, a pre-war racing driver who was MI5's most trusted chauffeur. As they neared the capital, Popov could see the menacing roseate glow over London. The Luftwaffe's bombers had departed, but the fires were still burning. In the lobby of the Savoy Hotel, a tall officer in the striking tartan trousers of an officer in the Seaforth Highlanders strode forward, hand outstretched. "Popov, hello, I'm Robertson." He looked, thought Popov, like Hollywood's concept of a dashing British military type. Popov felt an instinctive liking for another spymaster, this one on the other side. "Let's get acquainted," said the Englishman, ushering him toward the bar. "We'll get down to business tomorrow." This urbane, upper-class Englishman with distinctive trousers might have been welcoming a new member into one of London's more exclusive clubs, which, in a way, he was. Major Mertzinger's boast that Germany had many agents in England was entirely correct, but so far from being excellent, most of them were hopeless, many were actively disloyal, and a number were already working against Germany as double agents. The counter-espionage section of MI5, known as B section, was presided over by Guy Liddell, a shy, cello-playing spy hunter whose voluminous diaries offer an extraordinary insight into the wartime work of this remarkable secret organization. In combating German espionage, Liddell faced two overriding and interconnected problems: a huge host of spies who did not exist, and a second, much smaller body of secret agents who most certainly did. With the outbreak of war, Britain was gripped by what Liddell called a fifth column neurosis, the unshakable and all but universal belief that the country was riddled with enemy spies preparing to rise up if Hitler launched an invasion. This fear was stoked by spy novels, an excitable press, and a peculiarly British urge to play amateur sleuth. "There is a well-defined class of people prone to spy mania," wrote Winston Churchill, who had the mania himself. These imagined spies came disguised as nuns, butcher's boys, church wardens, and travelling salesmen. They appeared perfectly respectable. The head of Home Forces insisted that the gentlemen who are the best behaved and the most sleek are the stinkers who are doing the work, and we cannot be too sure of anybody. A spy might look like your bank manager. Indeed, he might be your bank manager. Robert Baden-Powell, the original scoutmaster, insisted he could identify a German spy from the way he walked, but only from behind. Reports flooded into MI5 detailing the nefarious activities of this hidden spy army. They were poisoning the ice cream, leaving marks on telegraph poles to guide the invading forces, drugging cigarettes, and training the inmates of lunatic asylums as suicide squads. When six cows stampeded on the tiny island of Ellenmore in the Scottish Hebrides, this was immediately ascribed to secret enemy activity. That the spies were invisible was merely proof of how fiendishly clever they were at disguising themselves. Even pigeons were suspect, since it was widely believed that enemy agents had secret caches of homing pigeons around the country that they used to send messages back to Germany. Britain's fear of spy pigeons would eventually come home to roost in a most unlikely fashion. These spy sightings were, as Liddell put it, junk, but the suspicion that Germany had launched an espionage campaign against Britain was entirely accurate. In July 1940, the Abwehr held a conference in Kiel, attended by Germany's most senior intelligence officers, at which a plan was drawn up, codenamed Operation Lena, after the wife of a senior Abwehr officer, to recruit and train dozens of spies and dispatch them to Britain to conduct sabotage operations, infiltrate British society, and collect information on troops, airfields, civilian morale, and anything else that might aid a German invasion. German spies began slipping into the country. They came by boat, submarine, and parachute. Some, like Popov, came legally or disguised as refugees. Of the 24 spies or so deployed to Britain between September and November 1940, 5 were German, while the others were variously Dutch, Scandinavian, Cuban, Swiss, Belgian, Spanish, and Czechoslovak. These were far removed from the super spies imagined by a nervous British public. Most were poorly trained and petrified. Some spoke no English at all, and had only a sketchy notion of the country they were supposed to blend into. They did not look like your next-door neighbour. They looked like spies. Only a few were genuine Nazis. The rest were variously motivated by greed, adventure, fear, stupidity, and blackmail. Their number included several criminals, degenerates, and alcoholics. According to one MI5 report, a high proportion suffered from venereal disease. Some had opportunistically volunteered to spy against Britain with the intention of defecting. Some were anti-Nazi from the outset. This motley collection of invasion spies had only this in common: not a single one escaped detection. The task of intercepting enemy spies was made immeasurably simpler after cryptanalysts at Bletchley Park, the British code-breaking centre in Buckinghamshire, cracked the Abwehr wireless code and began reading Germany's most closely held secrets. The breaking of the Enigma, the German cipher machine, was the most important intelligence triumph of this or any other war. Here was an information goldmine, referred to variously as Ultra or the Most Secret Sources, or MSS, and guarded more jealously than any other wartime secret. With access to the wireless traffic passing between Berlin and its Abwehr stations from the end of 1940, the British could track German intelligence operations from start to finish and plan accordingly. With advance warning from the Bletchley Park codebreakers, these incompetent and highly visible spies were easy prey. Once in custody, they were taken to the secret wartime interrogation centre at Latchmere House in Richmond, or Camp 020, under the command of Captain, later Colonel, Robin Stevens.